of your enemy. From Nahj al-Balagha, Hikmah number 295. The point here is that, of course, you need to make sure that you are someone who has a stance, has a mawqif. You always remember that you have your brethren. You need to stand with them, not in batil, but always in haqq. Remembering that we always need to cover and conceal the faults of our fellow brothers and sisters, those who are practicing Muslims.
Ayatollah Javadi Amali, the author of the book Mafatih al-Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafatih, ought to be in two volumes. One volume, the present volume, Mafatihul Janan, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc. But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree. Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam, who has stressed out the reward for praying, has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment. When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned. We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi, he says, Ya ma'ashar, O people, O ummah, man aslama bi lisanihi, someone who is a Muslim by their lisan, wa lam yukhlis al-iman ila qalbihi, and doesn't have that sincerity of faith in their hearts. لا تذموا المسلمون المسلمين ولا تتبعوا أوراتهم. Don't criticize fellow Muslims and don't follow their faults. Conceal their faults. You know, try to keep that level of brotherhood from one another. You know, try to keep their dignity. Try to remember that we're always going to make mistakes, but it is for us to cover up and for us to, you know, always remember to have benefit of the doubt, to forgive also if someone does make a mistake. We forgive them and we forget what it is that they have made as mistakes. Allahumma man rafaqa min ummati farfiq bihi wa man shaqqa alayhim fashuqqa alayh. You know, having that level of mercy, having that level of compassion, always remembering that you're going to make a mistake once, as we always need to keep that in our mind. And always remember that we need to do dua for our fellow Muslims, for our fellow believers. Also, visiting one another is a very, very recommended thing that is always important. And that's one of the huquq of our religion, Islam. And, you know, even shaking of hands, you know, the hadith says, تَصَافَحُوا تَتَسَاقَطُ ذُنُوبُكُمْ. Shake each other's hands and sins will fall apart. Here the hadith says, إِذَا تَلَاقَيْتُمْ فَتَلَاقَوْا بِالْتَسْلِيمِ. When you meet one another, meet with your salam. Greet one another. وَإِذَا تَفَرَّقْتُمْ فَتَفَرَّقُوا بِالْإِسْتِغْفَارِ. And if you separate from each other, separate with forgiving one another as well, and asking Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to forgive the sins of each other's person. We need to remember that, you know, you also need to be emotionally there for people. Number one, materially there. Number two, spiritually there. Morally there. Number three, moral support. Number three is emotional support. Walhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. والصلاة والسلام على أشرف خلق الله محمد وآله الطاهرين.
Driving past, walking fast to the field of dreams. Hear the children scream.
There Was the Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind. A momentary emotion, space spent in time, in time. Memories fade like a dusty window pane, and you can't see your past no more. The only thing that remains is that feeling of warmth in your heart that will always be there, be there.
In the limelight.
Floods are the most common disaster in the United States, and the 2020 hurricane season was the busiest to date in the Atlantic, 73% more active than normal. The Washington Post reported with a record number of storms breaking ground on U.S. soil, totaling $37 billion in damage. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Lena First Arai, writer. This article is published under the heading, Flood Risks Are Rising Amid Climate Change, but U.S. Congress is Delaying Action. Here's the details. Floods are the most common disaster in the United States, and the 2020 hurricane season was the busiest to date in the Atlantic, 73% more active than normal, the Washington Post reported, with a record number of storms breaking ground on U.S. soil totaling $37 billion in damage. The frequency of what is known as sunny day or high tide flooding linked to sea level rise and visible as water bubbling up from storm drains into city streets is also on the rise in the U.S. In 2019, the median flood frequency doubled from 2000 levels up to 4 days per year. That median is expected to rise to 6 days this year. By 2050, high tide flooding could reach 75 days annually. Given the heightened risk that the federal government's own data reveals, delaying the implementation of a system that takes those numbers into account is like putting your head in the sand and trying to ignore it. Caroline Kosky, executive director of the Wharton Risk Center at the University of Pennsylvania, told USA Today. The National Flood Insurance Program, NFIP, was created in 1965, primarily because private companies were not interested in insuring floods, as the Center for Public Integrity reports. The program, which backs over 5 million homes and businesses, is administered by FEMA, but requires regular congressional approval, and it has gotten repeatedly tied up in partisan politics. They have been kicking the can for almost 2 years now, Janie Babishi, director of the New York City Mayor's Office of Resiliency, told the Center for Public Integrity. But the overhaul is actually far more overdue than that, as the risk rating structure that premiums are based on have not been updated since 1970s. NFIP collects an estimated $4.6 billion in revenue from policyholders each year and delivers more than $1.3 trillion in coverage. The government flood insurance program was solvent until Hurricane Katrina, after which time it had to tap into U.S. Treasury to cover claims. It has since accumulated billions of dollars in debt, a problem made worse by the tendency to bail out the same policyholder repeatedly, rather than funding resilience or relocation efforts outside of a flood-prone area. In spite of its budgetary woes, NFIP also pays $1.4 billion in subsidies, primarily to the advantage of wealthy Americans that can afford coastal property, according to a report by R Street Institute, a nonprofit policy research organization. The subsidy payments effectively shield recipients from covering the true cost associated with paying into a risk pool substantial enough for an insurance company to pay the cost of recovery following a major storm. According to FEMA, just one inch of water can cause $25,000 in damage. Congress tried to overhaul the program in 2012 by passing legislation that would have eliminated those subsidies, but the attempt to do so was largely overturned 2 years later. The most basic purpose of government going back millennia is to protect its citizenry. Steve Ellis, Vice President of the nonpartisan budget watchdog group Taxpayers for Common Sense, told The Atlantic in 2017. But here you have a problem and a program that is subsidizing people to live and develop in harm's way. Since 2017, NFIP has been temporarily renewed, allowed to continue without a research-backed overhaul, at least 15 times. As Scientific American reports, one reason NFIP is unable to keep up with its claims is that its risk assessment model is based on antiquated flood maps. A 2018 study published in Environmental Research Letters found that an estimated 41 million people in the U.S. actually live in areas prone to serious flooding, whereas FEMA's maps estimate only 13 million are at risk. One of the biggest problems is that no flood map produced by FEMA contemplates a future that looks any different from the past. Robert Moore, a senior policy analyst for the Natural Resources Defense Council, said in 2018, "The flood insurance rate increases announced on April 1st are tied to what's known as risk rating, a new fully revamped system combining the United States Geological Survey 3D elevation data, National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration storm surge data, and U.S. Army Corps of Engineers data sets with catastrophe modeling technology. Implementation of the new rates is now expected on October 1, 2021. In a statement, an 8-2 Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer explained the delay in hikes as a protection for middle-class and working-class families who could face dramatic increases in premiums. But under the new approach, 96% of households would actually see no change, or an increase of less than $20 per month, according to the New York Times. The leaves 4% of households with flood insurance that could see drastic increases of up to 18% per year. The rate hike delay occurred without fanfare, first reported by an anonymous source to the New York Times. At a confirmation hearing for FEMA Administrator nominee Dina Criswell just days later, the NIP delay was not mentioned once, as disaster researcher Samantha Montano pointed out on Twitter. Montano expressed bewilderment that just days after Schumer said no to NFIP changes, they didn't ask Criswell about it. At least two other lawmakers besides Schumer have voiced support for the delay. New Jersey Representatives Bill Pascrell and Frank Pallon Jr., who on March 23rd wrote a letter to Department of Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas in support of postponing risk rating. Pascrell and Pallon each accepted $10,000 from the National Association of Retailers in 2020 alone. The trade group has spent millions in lobbying to oppose flood insurance reform, as Politico has reported. The two representatives previously co-authored a 2019 letter requesting the program be postponed, along with Gareth Graves, Charlie Crist, David Roser, Debbie Marcel Powell, and Francis Rooney. All signatories of the 2019 letter, except Rooney, have similarly accepted campaign donations from the National Association of Retailers, PAC, and or the National Association of Home Builders, PAC. Ahead of releasing the new risk rating system, access to the agency risk assessment is not publicly available. Based on modeling by Brooklyn-based research group First Street Foundation data, which may provide the closest working estimate of what flood insurance hikes could entail, there exists great variation within a given constituency. In Pascrell's district, residents of Little Ferry, where the median household income is $61,000, could see flood insurance premiums shrink by 71%, while residents of Tenelli, where the median household income is $169,000, could see premiums increase by 48%. Representatives Pascrell and Pallon have pointed to affordability concerns as their primary reason for advocating to delay new NFIP rates. They have specified they want FEMA to lower the premium rate hike limit to 9%. But as Joel Scotta of the Natural Resources Defense Council has written, simply providing affordable insurance will not alone adequately protect vulnerable areas, which are disproportionately home to communities of color and can unintentionally trap homeowners who might prefer to live outside of a floodplain if they were availed adequate information to make that decision. Any reforms aimed at providing affordable flood insurance must also be coupled with assistance that helps people reduce or eliminate their vulnerability to flooding in the future, Scudder wrote. Earlier in March, after years of advocating for assistance, residents of Horry County, South Carolina, received over $15 million for flood mitigation, including a community relocation program similar to what Escada and others have suggested. The program will help repeat flood victims make their houses more resilient or fully fund voluntary relocation. Terry Straka told WMBF she's lived in the community for 26 years and is tired of dealing with the perpetual rise and retreat of floodwaters, typical of what outdated NFIP risk rating encourage. Unless it's happened to you and you are a victim, you don't understand, Straka said. I'm happy that something right is happening for the people.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
It was a march that never happened on the occupied territories. Israeli settlers were supposed to hold a flags march in the occupied Jerusalem al-Quds, but it looked like as soon as the flags march was announced, it was cancelled. The reason? Hamas threatened to activate its missiles. All this was preceded by warnings and threats issued by the Palestinian resistance, where the head of Hamas in the Gaza Strip, Yahya Sinwar, stressed that if the confrontation with Israel erupts again, the shape of the Middle East will be different from what it is now. Sinwar stressed that the resistance is able to achieve deterrence and was able to make possible the accumulated force. Based on the order of how the announcement was then rescinded, after Hamas made this threat, it appears that Israel has surrendered to Hamas. This conclusion is also based on Israel's loss to the Palestinian resistance faction's victory over the Israeli regime recently in the 11-day war. Israel had to surrender, stop the war, and then go to Egypt to broker a permanent ceasefire. The U.S. administration also weighed in and called on Israel not to take steps that would ignite the situation in Jerusalem.
To say that there's a permanent ceasefire, I think, is dreaming. There has never been a permanent ceasefire, and there won't be one until the siege ends and the occupation ends and there's justice for Palestinians. So again, I think that that is really hyperbole. I do believe that the U.S. pressured Israel and said, you have done enough and time to stop. But again, we've seen this pattern over and over and over again. And so I am not particularly optimistic. I think there was also pressure because of the issue around the different parties trying to coalesce around toppling Netanyahu, and that fed into the outcome.
The situation in occupied East Jerusalem al-Quds remains tense, especially in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood. From forced evictions to the detainment of activists, the occupied neighborhood remains a tinderbox. Most recently, Israel detained a prominent female Palestinian activist in a raid on her home in Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood of the occupied East Jerusalem al-Quds. Mona al-Kord leads the Safe Jarrah campaign. It's a campaign which has been trying to mobilize actions against Israel's plan to displace dozens of Palestinian families from their homes in Sheikh Jarrah. She was released days later, but the evictions still continue, and hence the violent clashes between Palestinian resistance and Israeli occupying forces. Israel has been under heavy pressure from the resistance groups in Gaza and Lebanon. Days ago, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, the Secretary General of Hezbollah Resistance Movement, warned Israel that any aggression on holy sites in the occupied Jerusalem al-Quds would lead to regional war and destruction of the Tel Aviv regime.
Well, I do think that attacks on Al-Aqsa Mosque are incredibly dangerous and would ignite a tremendous amount of rage amongst Muslims all over the world and potentially a regional war. And I think it is very important that Israel not do this, and it would be catastrophic. Again, I cannot emphasize enough that Israel is a massive military power with nuclear weapons, with U.S. backing, and there have been many instances in the past where Arab nations have threatened to, quote, destroy Israel, and they have been quite unsuccessful. So I think we have to be very realistic in terms of the level of military might that Israel has, given the history of the region.
Furthermore, a report has revealed that both Hamas and Hezbollah chiefs had discussed a plan for the liberation of all Palestine. This was discussed last year and prior to the 11-day war. The recent blow dealt to Israel during the 11-day Gaza war was part of the liberation plan. The Palestinian resistance adopted tactics used by Hezbollah during the 2006 war by setting up mock rocket launch sites to deceive the Israeli Air Force. Yemen's Ansarullah also communicated with Hamas and requested coordinates for the site it wanted to target with missiles and drones, but Hamas told the popular movement not to intervene as long as the Israeli army had not crossed the red lines. Now, with a new cabinet being formed in Israel, this should serve as warning to the incoming administration to make sure the rights of Palestinians will not be violated and Palestinians will be allowed to pray in Jerusalem al-Quds. Palestinians, however, are not holding their breath. They are rest assured, however, that resistance groups like Hamas and Hezbollah have their backs.
Tensions are growing between the West and Belarus after Minsk scrambled a fighter jet to divert the flight path of a Lithuania-bound Ryanair passenger plane and forced it to land late last month. Minutes after the landing, Belarusian authorities arrested 26-year-old opposition blogger Roman Protasevich and his fiancé who were on the plane. The move infuriated the European Union and the United States.
And Belarus used its control over its airspace in order to perpetrate a state hijacking. Therefore, the safety and security of flights through Belarus airspace can no longer be trusted.
During a summit in Brussels, EU leaders urged carriers based on the bloc to avoid flying over Belarus. In addition, they have agreed to ban Belarusian airlines from using the bloc's airspace and airports. The 27-nation bloc has slammed more economic sanctions on Belarus. The EU says it has indefinitely frozen a 3 billion euro investment package for the country. Minsk's move has been slammed by some EU leaders as, quote, state piracy.
Essentially, Belarus is very highly aligned to Russia, and that is the choice that they made. Well, this doesn't sit well with U.S. imperialist efforts who want to see essentially all countries in the world allied to them and subservient to them. Now, this is part of a larger U.S. strategy to try to encircle Russia within Europe. As we know that the current Ukrainian crisis is going on right now, where NATO-aligned forces are going to be fighting Russian-aligned and full-on Russian forces probably sometime in mid-June when the permafrost finally melts and it's more advantageous to move large vehicles across Ukraine. Belarus is allied to Russia.
Belarus says it requested the emergency landing due to a suspected bomb threat on the plane. The airliner then left Minsk for its destination in Lithuania shortly after. In a video broadcast by Belarusian state media, Roman Protasevich said he was in good health and cooperating with the country's officials.
Hello, my name is Roman Protasevich. I was detained yesterday at the Minsk National Airport. I'm now in the Minsk Detention Center number 1. I can say that I don't have any health issues, including heart or any other organs disease. Police officers treat me properly and according to the law. Also, I now continue to cooperate with the investigation and give a confession on organizing mass protests in Minsk.
The opposition was quick to reject the statement, arguing that Protasevich was confessing under duress. But Belarusian President Alexander Lukashenko has denied any wrongdoing, accusing the West of seeking to provoke unrest in his country. In a meeting with his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin, Lukashenko said the West is trying to, quote, rock the boat to cause a new round of protests against his government. He was referring to the outbreak of protests after the 2020 presidential election when his opponent and Western countries accused his government of voter fraud. President Putin has also warned the West against meddling in Belarus's internal affairs. He also dismissed speculations that Russia participated in diverting the airliner.
This isn't simply someone being targeted by a country for you know, whatever reason, there is a very clear process here. A person is wanted for a crime, and if they pass through the country, then they are going to be stopped. I mean, this is not even comparable to, say, the Chinese Huawei CFO who was stopped in Canada for a crime that doesn't even exist there.
The recent incident wasn't the first that led to rising tensions between the West and Belarus, which is in a union state with Russia, and will certainly not be the last.
Yemen, the world's worst humanitarian crisis, according to the United Nations. The UN says 24 million Yemenis are in dire need of humanitarian aid, including 10 million suffering from famine. Yemen has struggled with mass outbreaks of infectious diseases, and poverty has surged to affect as much as 78% of the population since 2015, when Saudi Arabia and its regional states launched a devastating war on Yemen. The U.S. and several other Western countries have participated in the war by providing arms and logistic support for the Saudi coalition. The United Nations says the Saudi-led war on Yemen has caused an estimated 233,000 deaths, including 131,000 from an indirect cause such as lack of food, health services, and infrastructure. Meanwhile, the World Food Program has estimated that around 400,000 Yemeni children under 5 are likely to die of starvation in 2021. That is nearly one child every 80 seconds. While the results of the US-sponsored Saudi aggression on Yemen speak for themselves, Washington is trying to push a narrative that the Ansarullah movement is mostly to blame for the ongoing problems in Yemen, not Saudi Arabia. After returning from a trip to some Arab states of the Persian Gulf, including Saudi Arabia, the US Special Envoy for Yemen, Tim Lenderking, accused Ansarullah of refusing a proposed ceasefire. However, the movement has consistently participated in peace talks with the Saudis and allies of former Saudi-backed government. The main reason for the failure of previous peace talks was that the Saudis refused any deal involving power sharing or a fresh election. That's why the Saudi-enforced war on Yemen was aimed at bringing the Saudi-backed former regime to power and crush the popular Ansarullah movement. Despite years of ongoing aggression against Yemenis and spending billions of dollars, Saudi Arabia and its supporter, the U.S., have been unable to defeat the popular Ansarullah movement, and the recent willingness to negotiate a truce proves their weakened position.
The U.S. Narrative should be ignored because it has nothing to do with reality or truth. The people of Yemen continue to suffer because of U.S. actions, because of U.S. sending weapons to Saudi Arabia. Ansarullah movement has nothing to do with, I mean, they're defending the people of Yemen, certainly, but they are not the reason for the war. It is Saudi aggression financed by the United States that is the reason for the war.
The U.S. Special Envoy for Yemen has accused Yemen's Ansarullah movement of not trying to reach an urgently needed ceasefire in the war-torn country. That's why the Biden administration has refused to pressure Saudi Arabia into lifting the blockade on Yemen, which is a key Ansarullah condition for a ceasefire. The Saudi-enforced blockade has caused a lack of food and medicine. Meanwhile, the Ansarullah movement, as well as activists and international aid groups, have been calling on Riyadh to separate the blockade from the negotiations and not use the suffering of ordinary Yemenis as a bargaining chip. Moreover, the U.S. administration of Joe Biden has tried to show itself as a so-called impartial mediator, trying to resolve the ongoing conflict in Yemen. For instance, in February, the Biden administration announced that the United States was ending its support for the Saudi-led bombing campaign in Yemen. But Biden said Washington will continue to help Saudi Arabia defend its sovereignty and land. Washington's so-called defensive support for Riyadh includes providing maintenance services to Saudi Arabia's warplanes that are bombing Yemen.
When Joe Biden became president, he made some statements about no longer financing the war in Yemen, no longer supporting it, but he continues to send arms to Saudi Arabia. Now, he calls these defensive, but that's not what they're used for. As long as the profits continue to flow to the United States, government doesn't care who's dying. The U.S. government doesn't care whose blood is flowing, whose children are suffering and dying, as long as the profits continue to accrue to the United States. So that's what's happening now. Biden can say that he doesn't support the war anymore, but continues to send armaments that are being used in that war. So it's complete hypocrisy, which is typical for the United States. It's an ongoing, unfortunate tradition with the United States, and it's not going to stop under Joe Biden.
Washington previously announced it is halting its support for offensive Saudi-led operations in Yemen. But the U.S. is still helping Saudis in the Yemen war. Furthermore, Washington has refrained from holding Saudi Arabia accountable for the current crisis in Yemen as it has refused to pressure Riyadh into lifting the blockade on Yemen or to end its aggression. And that is a clear sign of the U.S. shielding of Saudi Arabia and Washington's contribution to this war.
Iran's foreign minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, has strongly condemned a United Nations decision to strip Tehran of its voting rights in the UN General Assembly.
This decision is fundamentally flawed, entirely unacceptable, and completely unjustified, as Iran's inability to fulfill its financial obligation toward the United Nations is indirectly caused by unlawful unilateral sanctions imposed by the United States to punish those who comply with the Security Council resolution.
In a letter to the UN chief, Zarif said, "Taking away Iran's voting privileges violates the UN Charter and the spirit of sovereign equality of member states." He said Iran failed to pay its dues because of extreme conditions imposed by the U.S. on its banking relations. Zarif stressed that Washington's, quote, "economic terrorism has faced Iran with difficulty buying food and medicine, let alone paying its UN fees." He accused the United States of attempting to mass-starve Iranian people and condemned the United Nations' inaction on anti-Iran sanctions. Zarif noted that nevertheless, his country remains committed to settling its arrears.
The UN should totally understand Iran's position. It's been sanctioned by the worst international sanctions ever imposed on a nation, arguably, in the modern era. And yet the United Nations has religiously decided to ignore the realities and the circumstances of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Of course, it goes deeper than this. The United Nations relies on the US of A for its funds. The majority of the funds that keep the United Nations going come from America. And of course, they're based primarily in the US as well. It's a misnomer to imagine that the UN is independent.
In the meantime, Iran maintains that it has always paid its dues to the international body, despite the sanctions. The spokesman for Iran's foreign ministry says the country has regularly paid its UN membership contributions during the past years, despite unilateral sanctions imposed by the United States on Tehran, which have made financial transactions difficult for the Islamic Republic. Saeed Khatibzadeh said Tehran has been in talks with the UN Treasury to settle the debt. He also urged the world body to introduce a self-transaction channel after the U.S. blocked the previous channels used by the Islamic Republic to transfer money. The foreign ministry spokesman said Iran has proposed using its frozen assets in South Korea to pay off the arrears. He said the United Nations Secretariat is completely aware of the details of the issue, which he said was not Iran's fault whatsoever. According to a statement by the UN General Assembly, as of 21st of May 2021, five member states are subject to provisions of Article 19 of the Charter, including Iran and the Central African Republic.
Nothing is being left unturned. No stone is being left unturned to make Iran bow. Islamic Republic of Iran is arguably one of the last nations still not to be part of the Bank of International Settlements, subjugated sovereign powers. There's a running theme. Those who control those institutions and have those levers of power don't want Iran to succeed in any way, because the Islamic Republic of Iran stands for a set of principles, primarily Islamic principles, but humanitarian principles and real principles of justice and fairness.
This is while the same article allows an exception for member states that can demonstrate that conditions beyond their control contributed to their inability to make payments. But the world body has so far rejected Iran's argument that the impact of the sanctions prevented Tehran from paying off its arrears.
The Light.
A herd of wild Asian elephants in China has turned into international stars after leaving their natural habitat in Yunnan province. The herd of 15 elephants is said to have left home in southwest China 15 months ago, but it was in April when they grabbed officials' attention after they were spotted by locals. The elephants have so far trekked nearly 500 kilometers across the country. They have traveled through villages and towns and even stopped for a rest. Local authorities have welcomed these mammoth travelers with treats of sweet corn and bananas. They are monitoring the elephants' movements with drones while keeping them away from residential areas.
Australian scientists have discovered one of the world's largest ever dinosaur species in the Eromanga area in outback Queensland. Research shows the plant-eating sauropod lived between 92 million and 96 million years ago when Australia was attached to Antarctica. Paleontologists estimated the dinosaur was as long as a basketball court and as tall as a two-story building. That makes it the largest dinosaur ever found in Australia and one of the top five largest ones in the world. Bones of the dinosaur were first uncovered more than a decade ago by cattle farmers. Iranian capital Tehran has hosted a festival of cake sculptors. The event showcases delicious sweets that are carved into eye-catching sculptures. Yusuf Jalali has more.
It's not a piece of cake to bake a sculpture, but pastry chefs here have made it. In the fourth festival of cake sculptures in Iran, sugarcraft artists from across the country have come under one roof in Tehran to cast their spell on these sweets and carve a wide range of fascinating 3D figures out of them. From this tasty coronavirus to this beautiful angel that is picking up the only eatable trash in the world.
Here you can see this angel, which represents the innocent heart of labor children, collecting pieces of trash that contain some of the simplest dreams of a labor child, such as quality food, books, and toys.
My cake is made based on what we call installation art. I have put together iconic structures and monuments of Iran. But when you take a look at them from a special angle, you can see Iran's map.
Some of the cake sculptures here have really pushed the envelope of the art of sculpting. Like this bust that shows the 13th century Persian poet Rumi, surrounded with a heavenly garden that's decorated with intricate and mind-boggling details. It took its creator almost a month to finish it.
In the middle, I have put the bust of Rumi, who we refer to as Maulana in Iran. He's holding his most significant verse work, Masnavi Manavi. The garden I created around him and the birds here all are inspired by his poems.
Organizers say they hold the festival every year to modernize the confectionery industry and combine it with fine arts to make it more appealing to the public.
500 works are showcased here in four sections. Bust cakes, wedding cakes, cookie cakes, which are made using royal icing, and the fourth section is cream cakes. The major goal is to scout for talents who can revolutionize the confectionery industry.
Some of the participants in the festival are pastry chefs who try to make their cakes look better, and others are actually pro sculptors who want to bake a figure instead of carving it. Perhaps it's easy to tell who is who by taking a glimpse at their cakes. But sweets will win the competition. They're both delicious. and delicate.
It takes ultimate care and a knack for both bakery and artistry to be able to transform sweets into statues. In fact, they're both so spectacular and yummy that make you want to have the cake and eat it too. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Nowadays, phone addiction is causing an increasing number of accidents worldwide. A Korean engineer has come up with a creative, although satirical, way to tackle that issue. Pang Min-wook is a 28-year-old industrial engineer or designer. He has invented a robotic eyeball people can wear to avoid accidents when using their phones while walking. The device is strapped to the forehead and opens its eyelids when the users lower their heads. The third eye then beeps in warning when the user comes within 1 or 2 meters of an obstacle. Pang says his device is not a solution to the issue and hopes that people will understand the severity of their reliance on gadgets when they see their third eye.
As the coronavirus continues to wreak havoc in India, some auto rickshaw drivers have turned their three-wheelers into makeshift ambulances to provide patients with first aid services.
Those are patients.
In New Delhi, the municipal ambulances are often occupied. There are also some very narrow alleys or built-up areas that are inaccessible by regular-sized ambulances. In these cases, our makeshift ambulances came in handy then. We attend to people in need with oxygen cylinders.
Mishra, who started the Rickshaw Ambulance Initiative, says his center attends around 1,200 calls per day. He says rickshaw volunteers transport roughly 150 patients during peak hours. The brave drivers work 12-hour shifts and mainly serve people with mild symptoms. They wear full protective gear, including face shields, while on duty. The three-wheeler ambulances are easily identifiable by the large printed image of the fleet and emergency call numbers. Mishra says the fleet will continue running with all its might until the coronavirus is under full control in India. In Russia, drone enthusiasts have gathered in the capital, Moscow, to show off their technological creativity in a racing competition. The participants created their own drones and made changes to the models right on the site where the competition was held to improve their chances to win the contest. The goal was for the participants to complete the track in the shortest possible time. Participants say the interesting thing about the competition is that it's cheaper than other games.
It's a lot of fun. From the outside, it may not be so clear, but when you're inside it, it becomes really fun to talk, race with the competitors, learn from their experience some new technological things. As for the high cost, it is expensive, but when compared with the snowboards and skis, it is really cheaper, but more expensive than knitting.
In 2017, the International Federation of Aeronautics, or FAI, announced drone racing as an official sport. In 2018, Russia's sports ministry included drone racing in all Russian register of sports with a class code F3U following the FAI classification.
A science professor has released spectacular drone footage of lava streaming from an Icelandic volcano. Sørensen Johnson flew a drone over the volcano 2 months after it started erupting. He captured close-up shots of lava bubbling in its crater in the southwest of Iceland's capital. The volcanologists say that they have no idea how long this eruption will continue, adding that magma could flow for years. Iceland is home to dozens of active volcanoes. Volcanic landscapes have turned into a tourist attraction in the Scandinavian country.
The Light is a short bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields, like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Two Russian cosmonauts have conducted spacewalk outside the International Space Station to prepare an old docking module for disposal. The duo spent more than 7 hours outside the ISS to wrap up preparations for the eventual disposal of the Pris docking compartment. According to NASA officials, the Russian cargo freighter will remove the two-decade-old module from the orbiting laboratory later this summer. Both the cargo ship and a press will burn up in the atmosphere above the Pacific Ocean. The orbiting press will clear the way for the arrival of a new Russian multipurpose laboratory module named Nuka, meaning science in Russian. Nuka is scheduled to launch on July the 15th this year. Wednesday's operation was the sixth spacewalk in 2021 in support of the Space Station Assembly, maintenance, and upgrades.
A rare albino baby elephant that was rescued from poachers in South Africa has found a new home with a welcoming herd. The calf, named Han Yi Sa, was caught in a snare in the Kruger National Park when she was only 4 months old. She suffered several nasty wounds, including one to her mouth. Han Yi Sa remained trapped in the snare for 4 days before being rescued and taken to a shelter especially built for elephants northeast of Johannesburg. All the other elephants there are orphans too.
Each female that we had has a baby. So except for them, all of the others are orphaned. And I think that is part of the reason why they accept these orphans, because they know how it feels, you know, and they become actually, you know, the mother figures for them.
The calf has learned to adapt to the new life. She lies under the shadow cast by bigger elephants to protect herself from getting sunburned. The shelter says if the herd grows too big for the area, she and other elephants will be released into the wild. A Brazilian artist has found a way to reuse plastic bags in a very creative way, making something beautiful out of them. Eduardo Sra turns recycled shreds of plastic into real pieces of artwork. He picks up the material from city streets and rivers. Without using a drop of paint, Sra recreates paintings by Picasso, Van Gogh, and other famous artists. He says his goal is to draw attention to plastic pollution.
I present this series as a product that does not have paint, except for what has already been processed into plastic by the industry. It does not have glue. It is a box that was built, and inside I press and condense it. I make an accumulated cluster of plastic bags that ends up creating this image that you see.
Sura's exhibition is due to open in Sao Paulo in the coming months. His previous works were also aimed at raising awareness about the environment. He has created several giant installations in public places, mostly along polluted rivers.
Chinese archaeologists have unearthed a rare 3,000-year-old bronze figure from a site they have been excavating for months in Sichuan province. The 1.5-meter figure, deemed one of China's most famous archaeological discoveries, it consists of two parts. The upper part is 55 centimeters high, with a zoon, a vessel used in ancient times, on top of the head. The lower part is 60 centimeters in size, with kneeling posture. Similar findings in the past were just 20 centimeters in their heights. The bronze figure was discovered under massive ivory objects. So far, over 500 objects, including ivory, bronze, gold, and jade ware, have been found from six sacrificial pits of the Sanjiangdu ruins. A Chinese man becomes the first blind Asian mountaineer to successfully scale the world's tallest peak, the Mount Everest. Zhang Hong completed the 8,849-meter high Himalayan feat with three high-altitude guides. The 46-year-old climber said he spent much of his trek holding onto his guide's arm. The pair said the most tiresome and risky areas were the so-called death zones, ice walls, and ice falls at around 8,000 meters. The Chinese climber recalled humbly embracing being part of Mother Nature after he completed his arduous journey.
No matter if you're disabled or normal, whether you have lost your eyesight or you have no legs or hands, it doesn't matter. As long as you have a strong mind, you can always complete anything that other people think you can't.
Zhang added that this is only the beginning. He said his next milestone is climbing the highest peaks from the world's continents known as the Seven Summits. The Chinese mountaineer lost his eyesight at the age of 21. After his success, he became the third visually impaired person to ever step foot on the Everest peak. A Russian company has developed a fully self-driving car that looks like it was taken right out of a sci-fi movie. Flip is the size of a conventional passenger car and has enough space for six people. Its creator says the advanced vehicle is a taxi of the future. Flip has fulfilled the requirements of international automated driving standards. It's powered by electricity, but it can also use other fuels like gas and hydrogen. The owners of this futuristic vehicle do not have to worry about running out of power. That's because its replaceable batteries can be changed in less than 5 minutes once they are out of electricity. A rare baby giraffe is born in a zoo in western France as conservationists try to increase the population of this endangered species. The cute Rothschild giraffe is the second born in a French zoo this year. Caretakers say the cubs will stay with a facility for 1 year before they would be sent to another site to start their own families. The Rothschild giraffes are critically endangered, and conservationists say that only 1,600 of them exist now. The general giraffe populations in the wild have also decreased by around 30% in the last three decades.
IRIB English Radio.